Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The ongoing repression of largely peaceful protests in Myanmar could descend into full-blown conflict on a par with Syria, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet warned on Tuesday. In a fresh appeal to the country's military rulers to stop using live ammunition on demonstrators, the High Commissioner urged states with influence to take immediate and impactful action to halt the slaughter of civilians. She warned that a small number of people had decided to arm themselves after security forces reportedly used indiscriminate weapons against them, including mortars. From the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, here's spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani in Geneva.
Over the weekend, credible reports indicate that the Tatmadaw forces opened fire with rocket-propelled grenades, fragmentation grenades, and mortar fire in Bago, in the south of the country. Security forces also reportedly prevented medical personnel from helping the wounded, as well as charging relatives a fine of roughly $90 to claim the bodies of those who were killed.
The development comes after the reported mass killing of at least 82 people in Bago on Friday and Saturday. More than 700 are reported to have been killed in the crackdown by the security forces since the military overthrew the government on the 1st of February. The UN Human Rights Office said that clashes between the military and ethnic armed groups had also intensified in Kachin, Shan and Kayin states, where the military have carried out airstrikes that have killed and displaced civilians. To Uganda now, where independent UN-appointed rights experts on Tuesday condemned the killing of more than 50 people by brutal policing methods linked to national elections held in January. In an appeal to the authorities to end the ongoing suppression of political opposition, including the use of live ammunition without warning, the experts also called on them to reveal the whereabouts of political opponents taken into detention. Several thousand people have been arrested and allegedly tortured before appearing in military courts, the experts said, while relatives often do not know their fate or whereabouts. Highlighting the case of prominent opposition leader known as Bobi Wine, the experts said that placing him under arbitrary house arrest at the start of the year was symptomatic of flagrant suppression tactics and the absence of due process of law. The experts, who form part of the Human Rights Council, explained that political leaders and their supporters in Uganda have protested against alleged electoral irregularities and the prohibition of gatherings under the guise of preventing the spread of COVID-19. The massive deployment of armed forces in cities, as well as the intimidation and attacks of opposition observers at polling stations, reportedly affected voter turnout, the experts maintained, adding that internet blackouts slowed the voting process too. The International Atomic Energy Agency said on Tuesday that it will work closely with Japan, which is preparing to release more than 1 million tons of contaminated seawater used to cool the stricken Fukushima nuclear power plant. IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi said that Japan's solution was both technically feasible and in line with international practice, and that the agency was also ready to provide technical support in monitoring and reviewing the plan's safe and transparent implementation. Controlled water discharges into the sea are routine practice for operating nuclear power plants in the world after safety and environmental impact assessments, the IAEA chief explained. Today's decision by the government of Japan is a milestone that will help pave the way for continued progress in the decommissioning of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, Mr. Grossi said, while also underlining that the large amount of water at Fukushima made this a unique and complex case. According to reports, Japan plans to start releasing the 1.25 million tons of contaminated seawater into the Pacific Ocean in 2 years, but only after it's been filtered and stripped of its most radioactive material. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alice Smith.
This show is not about how climate change will affect you. Enough about humans. Instead, we learn how heat waves kill off forests and the rush to save rare animals in Australia during the worst bushfires ever seen. It's time to hear what we do to plants and animals on Radio EcoShock. What will global warming mean? Will you buy air conditioning or need to move? Climate change sounds like a great drama for humanity, as though we live alone on a mechanical planet. In reality, we are small guests among billions of other living things, the animals, insects, plants, and more. They too will react. And we begin with the plant world, where new science reveals underappreciated plant vulnerabilities to heat waves. The lead author of that paper is David D. Brashears. David is Regents Professor at the School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Arizona in Tucson. In 25 years of publications, Brashears became the expert's expert on forests, grasslands, drought, and crops in a warming climate. From Arizona, David Brashears, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Is it true to say that human contributions to greenhouse gases are kind of small compared to the vast amounts of water and gases that plants cycle through the atmosphere?
Yeah, the plants cycle a lot of water. That's one of the main ways that water gets back into the atmosphere. We have evaporation from soil, and we have transpiration through plants.
When added to natural systems, though, it just seems to me that our greenhouse gases are the tipping point, that we are the tipping point into what was previously a relatively balanced system. And when the public thinks about tipping points, we tend to expect everything to change all at once. But a recent guest pointed out, no, it's for her more the point where things reach an inevitable decline or change. How do you define tipping points in your work, David?
Well, I particularly look at tree mortality. And so a tipping point there is when we begin to see trees die. And in particular, you know, if you go out to any particular forest, you can find maybe a few percent of the trees that die regularly just through old age and natural processes. What we're looking for in a tipping point is when we see a large number of trees die at a given time in response in particular to a given event, which now we see is usually drought and warmer temperatures, and that's what I've been focused on for much of the past 25 years.
Yes, looking through your earlier publications, I see some fairly detailed work and regional studies, but then you look at the global picture and you team up with other scientists to ask big fundamental questions like how will large living systems respond to climate change? For example, there's your 2010 co-authored paper, Climate-Induced Tree Mortality, Earth System Consequences. Please talk to us about how forest die-off feeds back into climate change.
Well, we're starting to ask questions about if you have a big enough change in the land surface, that changes the climate near the ground or the microclimate, and that can have exchanges with the atmosphere. And if that's big enough, it could influence circulation elsewhere. But the most important impact of having large-scale tree die-off is probably loss in carbon storage. So trees are a key part of our Earth's carbon storage system. And what we're really dealing with is a balance in the carbon or imbalance in which we're burning fossil fuels and putting a lot of carbon in the atmosphere. And if we continue to lose trees, we continue to lose carbon. And in fact, a lot of the plans that countries have for trying to address carbon emissions currently focus on adding more trees. And yet what our research has been showing us is that we're at risk of losing a lot of trees. So there's a little bit of a catch-22 in that we would like to have trees to help us slow our warming, and yet it's currently warming, and that warming is killing trees. So it's a bit of a catch-up game, and it's going to be difficult to get enough trees to store carbon. And so that really reverts us back to needing to directly reduce our carbon emissions rather than simply relying on forests to solve the whole problem for us.
I get it. And how serious is climate-induced tree mortality?
Well, we think that we're just beginning to see the tip of the iceberg. We have had a progression in our learning, and if I could, I'll go back in time and just give you a little walkthrough of a progression of understanding that's happened over the last 25 years.
Yes, please do that.
So my work began with a good colleague and friend, Craig Allen, who was at the time with the Band Blair National Monument. And we used historical aerial photographs to go back in time and look at the causes of a drought or the consequences of a drought in the 1950s. And at the time, This was in the early 90s when we were doing this research, and ecologists were starting to wonder more and more about what was going to happen with climate change. And in particular, they were expecting that we should see changes in ecosystems at the border, the ecotone, the boundaries between ecosystems, that that's the place where we might expect stress to show up first. And yet most of the studies that we had of how big and how fast ecosystems could change, they were studies that showed us very nicely that ecosystems could change over very large scales over long periods of time. So we had changes in vegetation that we could detect with pollen records that would show us changes over large scales, like a quarter of the northeast of the U.S. So we knew that vegetation changed over large scales. What we didn't know is how quick and fast some of these vegetation changes could occur. When we looked at these historical aerial photographs during this severe drought of the 1950s, we looked at the boundary or the ecotone between an upper elevation, cooler, moister ponderosa pine forest and a lower, drier pinyon juniper woodland. And what we saw was that there was lots of vegetation die-off, lots of tree die-off of ponderosa pine at its lower end of its distribution. And so effectively, we saw the ecotone shift more than 2 kilometers in less than 5 years. So that's a pretty big shift in a very short amount of time. And we also saw that that shift was pretty persistent. We had records up through the 1980s in terms of aerial photographs, so up through 30 years later after the shift, and the vegetation recovery had still not occurred. And in the mid-90s, going out into the field to observe these locations, we could see that the vegetation recovery had still not changed. So we have a big, fast change associated with drought at the ecotone occurring, and that's where we were expecting the biggest changes to happen. And so that was sort of the first part of our conversation about thinking about how much drought-induced tree mortality might happen as we start to see climate change. So we were concerned about drought. We thought it would be a long time till we got to the next chapter of the story, but in 2001 and 2002, another drought hit the same landscape. And I was studying a ponderosa pine woodland in the area, and this ponderosa pine woodland was at its upper elevation. So for that species, it was at the wetter location of its distribution. So it's the location that you would expect if you go into a drought would be a bit safer. Well, during this drought in 2001 and 2002, we had more than 90% of our pinyon pine trees died. So it was a really extreme die-off. And importantly, it didn't happen at the lower ecotone. It happened all up and down the distribution of this species. And so that even at the best sites for this species, we had lost 90% of the vegetation, or 90% of the pinyon pine, I should say, which was about half of the tree species. There was a tougher species there, juniper, which most of the juniper survived that drought. So we had a very big change in the landscape due to that tree mortality. And we looked and thought, well, this must be a worse drought than the 1950s. And we were really focused on the drought component. And what we saw was that this drought was not any worse than the 1950s in terms of precipitation, but there was a increase in temperature. And during the maximum, sort of averaged over the summer months, there was about a 0.2 C warmer temperature, but there were also some extremes there. So we started coordinating with other researchers across the Southwest, and we saw that this event didn't just happen in one location, but it happened across much of the southwestern U.S. And what we determined was that this drought had worse impacts, not because it was a worse precipitation drought, but because it was a hotter drought. At the time, we called it a global climate change type drought. Now we're using a term hotter drought. So it was a hotter drought than it occurred in the 1950s. And we realized that this was going to be one of the key risks, one of the key threats of climate change, is that even if drought doesn't change, we know with a lot of confidence temperatures warming. We know that warming temperatures are one of the most persistent and pervasive effects of climate change. And so even if droughts stay the same and don't get worse, the next drought is going to be a hotter drought. It's going to be associated with warmer temperatures. So we speculated in this paper that it was hotter drought that killed the trees and made things worse, and that this might be a harbinger of what we were going to see in the future. The next step in the story takes place at Biosphere 2. I had moved to University of Arizona, and we had the opportunity to take over Biosphere 2, which is the large glasshouse facility you may have heard about that was originally used to see if people could live off the planet in a self-contained environment. But it's an important experimental facility because it's the world's largest greenhouse, essentially. And what we did in that greenhouse in Biosphere 2 is we took trees and we wanted to test our idea or our hypothesis that hotter drought would kill trees faster. Now, that sounds to a non-scientist like a really stupid question, like the answer should be obvious. But it's one of the most fundamental questions of climate change, and it's something we hadn't tested. And in addition to knowing, does hotter drought kill trees faster, we also wanted to know how much faster and how sensitive would a species be, and to get some other associated physiological measurements off the plant. And so we took pinyon pines, which are relatively small trees, and we dug up some sapling size, close to small adult size trees, and we brought them into Biosphere 2, and we put them in two different locations. One location had climate close to the average temperature for that species, and another location had hotter temperature. And not surprisingly, we saw that hotter temperature kills trees faster. And so this was sort of a confirmation of what we were seeing in the field. And so those two things together suggested that hotter drought was going to become a problem. And that leads us to the paper that you were talking about, where we started to take a look globally to see if we could see evidence for trees dying around the planet.
Are we sure, though, that planet Earth is losing more trees in the hotter zones that you describe than it produces in wetter regions like the boreal forest?
Yeah, we're not sure yet. There are places where we're having increases in tree cover, and there's woody plant encroachment, which is a term referring to trees invading grasslands or other areas where trees aren't occurring. There's changes in the fire regime that sometimes allow trees to expand. So currently, it's hard to say if there is a net increase or decrease in tree cover overall. And in fact, a lot of the models that we have of the environment say that we should be getting an increase in tree cover through time. However, those models don't really have good ways to predict tree mortality. We don't understand the underlying mechanism that causes tree mortality. Just like it's hard to predict longevity in people, or it's hard to predict when an individual is going to die, it's hard to predict when a tree is going to die. And there's a lot of complex factors that go into understanding the environment, and there's a lot of complex physiology happening inside the tree that we don't really fully understand enough yet to be able to make good predictions about when trees are going to die. What we've learned so far is that for the species that have been looked at, whenever you have hotter temperatures with drought, you get an increase in tree mortality. And what our global look revealed was that we looked back over the 30 years into previous research studies, and we found lots of examples of trees that had died with drought and warming, And it wasn't enough by itself to suggest that we have a trend in increased tree mortality. But combined with the other work, which was observational and experimental, it suggests overall that we are going to have a lot of tree mortality in the future.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the University of Arizona. We are speaking with Professor David Brashears about the impact of the new heat on plants as the world warms. Well, again, David, this new work changes our perceptions. The Intergovernmental Panel's work is focused on, and so much popular press emphasizes, that long, steady curve upward of temperature as carbon ramps up. But what if extreme events are more important than global averages?
Yeah, that brings us to heat wave. The story that I just told you was about drought and average warming, or what we might call chronic warming. Some colleagues of mine in Australia came up with some additional observations that really added a new chapter to the story to help us think about heat waves, which we could think about as acute warming, very short events punching in and hitting the biota. One of the things that's interesting is we know that heat waves are very, very bad in terms of human population. We see lots of increased human mortality in cities when we have extreme heat waves. And probably other biota we might expect are going to be sensitive to heat waves too, but we don't have the research there to evaluate that yet. What my colleagues in Australia did was they saw that in one of these examples from around the world where we had tree mortality occurring with drought and average warming, what they saw was there was also a large heat wave spike that occurred. And right after that heat wave, lots of the trees died. And so it was a short heat wave on top of a hotter drought. And that short heat wave really kicked in and caused a lot of tree mortality. At first, they reported it for a couple of species. And then we started working together and tried to collect a lot of information. And it turned out this heat wave was an enormous heat wave in 2011. Went up and down the coast of Western Australia, so that's about the size of California, and there were more than 10 species of trees and shrubs that were impacted there. And I want to read you just a short quote from the summary of that paper, because what we did is we looked at the effect of this heat wave on the land, and this heat wave was big enough that it was also lingering over the marine system too. So we had a heat wave, like a great big blob, sitting across both the land surface and the ocean surface, and it impacted all types of things. Tree die-off and coral bleaching occurred concurrently in response to the heat wave and were accompanied by terrestrial plant mortality, seagrass and kelp loss, population crash of an endangered terrestrial bird species, plummeting breeding success in marine penguins, and outbreaks of terrestrial boring insects. These multiple taxa and trophic level impacts spanned more than 300,000 square kilometers, comparable to the size of California, encompassing one terrestrial global biodiversity hotspot and two marine World Heritage areas. So we had enormous impacts from this heat wave in 2011, both in terms of the extent and in terms of impacting lots of different biota. So that has really raised our concern that heat waves or these short acute warming events may be a trigger for what might happen in the future in terms of impacting biota and ecosystems.
Yes, Australia. In Australia in 2019, they had fires starting in December that burned, I'm told, up to a third of their deciduous forests down to the ground. That's a magnificent change on a big continent. What would be the effect of such large-scale losses during heat waves and droughts and those fires?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we talk about, and I'm not sure to the extent that the 2019 event was involved with heat waves per se, but it was a chronic hotter temperature that probably had some heat waves interspersed within it. But that dries out the vegetation. That results in a huge loss of biomass. It can impact soil biota. It can impact the soil stability. So after fires, we're generally worried about flooding and loss of soils and the impacts that floods can cause on dwellings and things nearby. So the impact of heat waves is really potentially quite large, and it's similar to the types of concerns that I raised when I said that if we lose a lot of trees, we lose a lot of carbon. Trees also provide structure. You think about, you know, when you think about what you call an ecosystem, say whether you call it a grassland or shrubland or a forest, deciding whether it's a forest or a savanna, say, is determined by, is there tree cover and how much tree cover is there? If you lose a lot of trees, you may change the microenvironment, and that impacts a lot of different organisms below it as well. One of the reasons that we're so concerned about heat waves is that if you have a bit of warming, you get a whole lot more high temperature events. So in particular, we looked at an example in Perth, and we compared historical temperatures, 1911 to 1936, with more current temperatures, 1989 to 2018. And you could see that the temperature distribution had shifted up warmer a bit, and it had gone up about a degree or two. But then if you look at the extreme event that occur there, we first looked at, well, how many more days do we get now that are hotter than 40 degrees C, so about 100 Fahrenheit? And that number of days, about 40 degrees C, doubled in that period. So you can see that with a small shift in the average temperature, you get a big increase in the frequency of extreme events. And then we used a more formal definition of a heat wave, which is 3 consecutive days or more of temperature that's above the 90th percentile. And there we saw a 50% increase in the number of heat wave events. So a doubling of the days over 40 degrees C and a more than 50% increase in the number of heat wave events. That's an illustration from Perth, but that's a basic property of having temperatures shift warmer. So everywhere where we have warming occurring, which is most of the planet on average, everywhere where we have warming occurring, you're getting that type of pattern where you get many more extreme events. So when I say I think that we're seeing the tip of the iceberg in terms of tree mortality, as warming progresses, we're going to probably see a lot more of these mortality events because we're going to have a big increase in the frequency of extreme events.
You know, the contradiction I have trouble wrapping my head around is I talk with other scientists who say we're heading into a wetter world. We're going to have more urban flooding. We're going to have extreme rainfall events. And you're from Arizona, and your cohorts are from Australia, talking about drought and a drying world. So how can both of these happen at the same time?
Yeah, well, one of the things that is happening with climate change, we call it the intensification of the water cycle. We're having more extremes of different types. So just like if we have an extremely big, unusual winter storm, that doesn't mean that climate change isn't happening. In fact, the effects of climate change are that we're going to have more extreme events of a variety of types. So both types will occur, but what you can think about is everywhere sort of has droughts, and sooner or later, a location is going to have a drought, relatively speaking, on average. And that drought is going to be hotter than prior droughts. And because of this argument that I just presented about the distribution, you're going to have an increase in the frequency of heat waves. So all of those things are going to come into play. That's not to say that there might not be interspersed with extreme flooding or extreme wet events, but there definitely is going to be an increase in hotter, drier events that are extreme that are likely to take trees out.
Well, we don't have the luxury of just waiting throughout this century to see how it happens and record it all down. because we have some severe threats we might have to deal with. So you suggest there might be ways we could test this out, and you've touched on that with the biosphere experiment. How can we test out what the limits of plants are so we know what we're up against?
We need to do some quick trials on some of the key plant species that we care about. Those might be species that are widespread, or they might be species that are good representative plants for our models that we use to model the whole Earth system. And we have four different types of questions that we might ask. The first is just confirming or testing a heat wave. Does it matter? So putting plants in a chamber and asking if you have a heat wave or not, does that kill the plants? How much faster does it kill the plants? Which species are more sensitive than others? Second variation of that experiment would be to vary the duration of the heat wave. So what happens if you have a 3-day heat wave, a 5-day heat wave, a 10-day heat wave? How much difference does that make? And what are the implications of that for those different species? Then we can also vary the magnitude of the heat wave. What if the heat wave is 5°C over normal? What if it's 8°C over normal? What if it's 10°C over normal? How much does that matter? And then finally, we can combine those with asking how much does the base temperature matter? So if we have that chronic average warming and that goes up by 2°C, 1.5°C, 4°C, how much does that matter? Are heat waves equally devastating under different base temperatures of warming? That's a series of trials that we've proposed in this new paper. I do want to make sure that I save time to end on a positive note about what could be done about all this.
Well, this is the time. We are going to have to wrap it up.
Okay, well, let me recap three key points that I'd like to leave the listeners with. The first thing is that we've gone through a progression of thinking about drought to hotter drought with chronic warming to hotter drought with these heat waves that look like together they're posing a big threat to our systems. And second, as it gets warmer and warmer, the distribution shows us that we're going to get a lot more of these heat waves. And given the uncertainty of heat wave effects, we need these trials that I just talked about. The last thing that I want to leave listeners with is that every bit of reduction in warming could help. We have one study in which we've seen with chronic warming that trees keep dying faster and faster as the temperature gets hotter and hotter. And we know that if we shift the distribution upward, we get a big increase in the frequency of extreme events like heat waves. But if we shift the distribution back down, then we can get a reduction. So it's very important that we not slide the distribution up any more than necessary, any more than we can avoid. So the positive news is that every bit of reduction in warming could have a large positive effect on helping us reduce the amount of tree mortality that we're going to experience in the future. And that's going to be important to trying to save as much forest as we can to hold carbon in, as opposed to losing forest and lose that carbon and amplify the warming.
From the University of Arizona, we've been speaking with Professor David D. Brashears, and you can find links to his free access paper that we've been talking about, Underappreciated Plant Vulnerabilities to Heat Waves, in my weekly show blog. I'll put a link there at ecoshock.org. David, thank you for taking the time to help us out. I appreciate talking with you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Just before the Northern Hemisphere slid into a global pandemic, Australia went through a kind of hell of fire. Dozens were killed, thousands of homes were lost, as climate-charged heat set a continent, a whole continent, ablaze, really. Maybe you saw a video of frightened campers on beaches surrounded by flames, or a woman rushing in to grab a koala with burned feet And I tried to look away from roadside video of kangaroos passed out or dead along the road. This was a world-sized climate disaster for the most unique wildlife left on Earth. And there's nobody better to tell us about it than John Pickrell. He has a Master of Science from the Natural History Museum in London. Pickrell edited Australia Geographic at one point. I've seen his work in Scientific American, New Scientist, The Guardian, and at the BBC. He's the author of two books on dinosaurs. John's new work is Flames of Extinction, The Race to Save Australia's Threatened Wildlife. It's coming out in April of 2021. From Australia, John Pickrell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you.
In Australia, the black summer of 2019-2020 was just another fire season, but it wasn't really, was it? Give us an idea of the scale of what happened there.
This past summer, the summer of 2019-2020, was just kind of off the charts in terms of the scale of the fire season. I mean, there have been big bushfire seasons in Australia before, but usually you would have a bushfire disaster maybe in one state at a time. But really, there were very major bushfires burning across four or five different states simultaneously. And more than that, really, just the scale of area burnt was just absolutely off the charts. We're talking about more than 20% of Australia's entire kind of temperate forest cover that was burnt over the 2019 to 2020 summer. And that's pretty much bigger than has been recorded on any continent that's lost 20% of its forest cover.
Well, fires also burned here in the West, you know, California, Oregon, Colorado. It was pretty bad, but it always bothers me when the news reporting sums it up with the number of people killed or the number of homes burned or the outbuildings burned, and they leave it at that. They really don't get into what is happening with the animals. What drove you to report on what the plants and animals have gone through with this Australian fire disaster?
I think you're right about that. And certainly in Australia, there seemed to be a lot more of the focus on the damage to wildlife and ecosystems here following the crisis than I saw in the coverage of the US. And I think that's partly because Australia sort of has such unique wildlife here anyway. But I'd covered a whole series of stories for international publications over the summer as the bushfire crisis was unfolding. I was reporting stories for Science and Nature, National Geographic and Guardian. And I just spoke to many, many different ecologists, and it just became really clear over the summer that the scale of the damage to wildlife and ecosystems was beyond anything that had been seen before in Australia, not just with bushfires, but it's beyond any kind of ecological disaster that we've seen before in Australia. But also that there were many dedicated people out there who were trying to assess the damage and work out what could be done to save species, protect species in the future. And I felt that there was a much bigger story to be told here, and a bigger story to be told about people's personal experiences and stories during the bushfire crisis. And I wanted to bring that to a wider audience, and that's kind of how the idea for the book was born.
Well, yes, there's the long tail, the after effect to talk about. And I think some of that got wiped out by our focus on the pandemic so that we really didn't understand how big this disaster was. Certainly outside of Australia, people didn't get it, in my opinion.
Yeah, it is true that the pandemic sort of absolutely shifted people's focus away from the bushfires here in Australia. And there's been a bit more thinking about it in the recently, with it really being the 1 year anniversary of the fires. But the other thing that probably has shifted focus away from it is that we shifted from very dry El Nino, from very dry conditions in Australia, a long drought, 2 to 3 year drought to La Nina conditions, which are very wet. And so we've had drenching rains this summer, and really there's been very few bad bushfires to speak of in southeastern Australia. So it's really the combination of the pandemic and the wet summer this year have shifted people's focus away from the danger and what we may face again in future years.
Yes, I think that's one of the things about fires is that they don't come every year. And the same with hurricanes. And so you get a couple of off years, and humans have pretty short-term memories in a lot of ways, and we tend to forget. And so I think that we have to somehow let people know that this is part of climate change, that things will come as extreme events, and then the next year may be okay, a year after that, but the extreme events happen more often. Is that the kind of thinking that you encounter?
I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that we're going to have years with huge mega fires again here in Australia. I mean, the conditions that led to the fires in 2019, 2020 really was an unprecedented drought. So we'd had kind of 3 years of very bad drought right across eastern and southern Australia. And it had led to there being very little moisture left in ecosystems and environments, which led to the fires. But Australia really constantly goes through cycles of drenching rains and cascading droughts that, you know, come around every 10, 20, 30 years. The difference now is that along with the droughts, you know, the droughts are worse, but we have very extreme heat waves at the same time. So there is absolutely no doubt that we're going to come back to these mega fires again. And a lot of scientists and ecologists and national parks realise this, and they're already planning and thinking of some of the things that we're going to have to be much better prepared to do next time this rolls around again. So it is, I think people, you know, maybe not the general public, but certainly scientists and park managers realise that with climate change, this is a problem that isn't going away.
Yeah, a lot of people just love the fuzzy koala bears, and they make that their center of attention. And you do cover it in your book, early on in your book. So how many koalas were lost, and why so many, and what has been done to try and save the survivors?
Yeah, certainly koalas were a big focus, and they sort of became the poster child of the crisis, and they definitely got a lot of coverage overseas. But I mean, koalas were just one of many, many species that were incredibly badly impacted during the fires. But I mean, the full toll on koalas is now thought to be perhaps about 60,000 of a population, total population of koalas of perhaps about 330,000. But koalas are very difficult to count, so it's actually difficult to get a good estimate of the full size of the population and the number that were killed. But it is thought to be about 60,000. And what that means is that the koala is likely to have its threat status recategorized from vulnerable to endangered in some states in Australia. And that's something that the government is actually considering here at the moment. I mean, yeah, the crisis on koalas has been very bad, but it was patchy. So there are large parts of koala habitat that were not impacted. So there are some populations that are relatively secure, but there are other populations that were already suffering from many other problems. I mean, there's a big problem with chlamydia in many koala populations in New South Wales and Queensland, with car strikes and dog attacks. So the koala already had many problems in the lead up to the crisis. But I think really what needs to happen now is that as much remaining koala habitat is shored up as possible. And really what has been driving the decline of koalas in recent years has been development and land clearing. So the government, particularly in New South Wales and Queensland, needs to take a much tougher line on this. And in fact, in the wake of the fires, the New South Wales government began to look at changing legislation, increasing restrictions on land clearing and other measures to protect koala habitat. But it led to a kind of big rift within the leading coalition in the state of New South Wales, and it meant that these positive changes for koalas didn't get passed in the end, been put on the back burner. But we have to hope that they come back to this legislation against land clearing that is really going to help protect them into the future.
Yes, I'm picturing a federal and state government in the most extreme emergency imaginable. I mean, capital cities might burn down. How could conservation experts and animal lovers get their voices into that almost panicked response during multiple firestorms?
Yeah, certainly during the summer, it's true that the focus was very much on saving human lives and property and much less on wildlife. And it wasn't really until kind of a little bit later in the crisis that there was more talk about the impacts on wildlife. But certainly wildlife carers and rescuers were out there trying to save as many animals as possible. And also there were a number of rescue efforts mounted for endangered species, including the Wollamai pine in New South Wales, a living fossil, a dinosaur era tree that sort of persists just as about 100 or so remaining individuals in a couple of months in Wollamai National Park. northwest of Sydney, and that got a little bit of coverage internationally, but certainly the focus was more on saving human lives and properties. But I think there is a recognition now that in future, firefighting resources also have to be put towards protecting endangered species and ecosystems. And in fact, in the state of Victoria, in Australia, they already, under their legislation, they're able to direct some of the firefighting resources to specific important species or habitats. So I think there maybe needs to be more of a model across Australia as a whole where firefighting resources can be put to sort of protecting some of these priceless natural treasures as well.
Well, this is one reason I find your book, Flames of Extinction, it's about hope as much as horror. Many Australians really care about animals and plants in that unique land. Can you talk to us more about the rescue efforts that got going?
Yeah, well, I talked a little bit about the Wollamai Pine. So the effort with the Wollamai Pine involved firefighters being helicoptered into this remote canyon, a couple of hundred kilometres to the northwest of Sydney. And they'd actually set up an incredible irrigation system in this canyon as well, because like I was saying, there are only about 100 remaining individuals of this very rare kind of dinosaur era pine tree left in this canyon. And they set up an irrigation system, and then basically the firefighters were being helicoptered in each day. There were some pools of water there that were filling from natural spring. They'd set the irrigation system up just to moisten down the whole environment, and the pools would dry up during the day, and they'd be helicoptered in again the next day to set pumps going in the irrigation system up again. And they knew that in this area to the northwest of Sydney and the Blue Mountains, so there was no doubt that the fire was going to pass through the canyon here at some point, but really their goal was to moisten the environment enough so that it would be a much less intense fire that would pass through. And as the fire got closer and closer, they were actually flying in and water bucketing the trees as well. And what ultimately happened was that they were able to save most of the trees. Fire didn't pass through, but most of them went through the understory, and very few of the trees got scorched or burnt in the crown, and the majority of them seem to have survived. So that rescue effort in New South Wales involving the Rural Fire Service and the National Park staff just really showed what was possible when there is particular focus on saving an endangered species. And that wasn't the only rescue effort. I mean, in Victoria, like I was saying, they're able to direct some of the fire service effort through legislation into protecting wildlife. So there was an effort to save an endangered bird called the eastern bristlebird that really actually involved a whole group of scientists and national park staff and others going in and capturing a bunch of these birds before the fire front could reach them and taking them into captivity. And there were similar efforts for other species as well. So in the Blue Mountains to the west of Sydney, there was an effort to go in there and collect a whole number of koalas. I think they took about 12 koalas in the end. And they have the koalas in the Blue Mountains. Blue Mountains are an unusual subpopulation. They're the highest altitude population of koalas in Australia, and they have a very high level of genetic diversity as well. But it was important to save some of these koalas, and they took about 12 of them into Taronga Zoo in Sydney, and they sat out the rest of the summer in the zoo before they were radio collared, and they were able to be returned to the wild again. Similarly, after the fires, there were some ecologists that went out and caught some critically endangered fish in alpine streams in southern New South Wales. And the problem with fish and other system, and other creatures in aquatic ecosystems, is it's often not during the fire itself, but kind of after the fire, when a lot of ash and soot and crack and other stuff get washed into the rivers with rain that cause problems. So these ecologists have gone out directly after the fires, and maybe they were able to catch quite a large number of these critically endangered fish, which are now in aquariums. So really, there were a whole bunch of rescue efforts that were happening across Australia, either before fires reached places or to go and help survivors after the fires. And it showed what was possible and what might be possible in the future.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is science journalist John Pickrell, and we're talking about his new book, Flames of Extinction, The Race to Save Australia's Threatened Wildlife. John, we know from other guests that some landscapes are adapted to fire. Seeds can survive if they're evolved for it. But the Canadian fire expert Mike Flanagan told us that there's two reasons why forests may not come back. And one is that, of course, if they experience a drought right after and the seedlings don't flourish. But also, if the fires return within 3 to 5 years, that interrupts the cycle and then you get a different landscape. What are your thoughts about what's going to happen? I think you said in the book 20% of Australia's forests were lost in this one season. What's going to happen there?
Yeah, this is absolutely a big problem. There are many plants in Australia that are fire adapted. And in fact, there are many that require fire to come through the ecosystem for the seeds to germinate. And for some of these species, really, the seeds won't germinate and the young trees won't come through unless the fire has passed through. But some of these species, such as tall eucalypts in southeastern Australia called the mountain ash and the alpine ash, fire might come through these systems naturally, maybe every 30 years. And certainly for the alpine ash, there have been bushfires that have passed through a lot of its forests, in some places 5 times in the last 20 to 30 years. So it's really an unprecedented frequency of fire that is passing through these ecosystems. And the problem is it takes kind of 20 to 30 years for the trees to grow to adulthood and be able to produce seed again. And if the fires come through too frequently for the trees to be able to reach adulthood and produce seed, then the outcome is that those trees are killed. There are no seeds left to replace them. And these trees are actually being removed from these ecosystems. So particularly in Victoria, there has been a big effort over the last couple of decades to artificially seed these forests. And I know that's something that happens in California with some of the species there. But in Australia, that's been very uncommon. But in the last 20 years, they've been taking seed up, which is spread from a hawkwind or a helicopter. But with these alpine ash forests, really, it's just been a wasted effort because the fires have passed through again before the trees are able to set seed. And after the fires this year, I think there's kind of big questions now about whether there's any point in continuing to reseed in this way, and whether there needs to be a focus on kind of protecting specific smaller refuges of these kind of trees and forests that have natural protection from fire. And really, maybe the focus should be on trying to help these species persist in these enclaves rather than in these wider habitats that are going to be burnt ever more frequently now. And it's not just these trees. I mean, there are hundreds of fire-tolerant species in Australia that would require some frequency of fire, but that are really going to struggle with high frequency of fire. And in the wake of the fires from 2019 to 2020, there's about 250 plants now that had sort of 20 more than 25% of their entire range of burnt in this last fire season, and are struggling with this increased frequency of fires. I mean, there's about 250 plants that probably need to be considered for adding to the endangered species list now.
There are climate deniers in Australia, as there are everywhere else. They say Australia has always burned. Aboriginal people did it too. It was just a hot year, not the climate. You've heard it all, John. How can we be confident these fires are part of the new climate-driven future?
The scale of the fires this year was just massively beyond anything ever seen before. I mean, I said that figure about 20% of the forest cover burning. In bad bushfire, forest fire seasons previously in Australia, no more than about 5% had burned. So it really, really was on a different scale. I mean, we're talking about 18 million hectares across, largely across southeastern Australia that burnt. I mean, that was as big as entire countries, you know, similar size to like Guatemala or Ireland that had burnt this year. And just to see such an enormous impact on species as well. I mean, just looking at the percentage of the ranges of species that have burnt, there's about 230 species of insects and other invertebrates now that really need to be added to endangered species lists. So the impact of that 2019-2020 fire season is probably that more than 500 species now need to be added to endangered species lists, and nothing like that. I mean, not just in terms of fires, but nothing like that in terms of ecological disaster has ever been seen in Australia, if in any part of the world before.
And it goes the other way, of course. When 11 million hectares of trees go up in smoke, tons of carbon dioxide rise up into the atmosphere, and the atmosphere is already overloaded with it. How did the Black Summer fires add to climate change? Do we know that?
Yes. The amount of carbon produced during the fires was kind of equivalent to Australia's normal entire contribution to greenhouse gases. And so I don't have the figures to handle, but I did have them somewhere here in my book. But yeah, it was absolutely enormous contribution to greenhouse gases to be producing Australia's normal amount just within a couple of months simply from the fires. Yeah, hang on, I've got the figures here. Yeah, I mean, about somewhere between 650 million and 1.2 billion tons of carbon dioxide was pumped out during the fires. And that's equivalent to the annual emissions of all the world's commercial airliners. And it's actually more than Australia's typical total CO2 emissions, which were about 531 million tons. So, it was a pretty staggering impact.
Yes, even if you don't live in Australia, you're about to get some heat that comes from that released carbon, and we don't know how well it can be recaptured. And that's one thing that I think is not fully investigated, really. It's how the hydrological cycle is affected by vegetation burned off on such a vast scale. I wonder how, well, will we get more drought because the plant system is damaged, or will soils be washed away because they can't handle flooding rains? We don't know yet.
I mean, certainly in Australia this summer, because we've had so much rain, I mean, a lot of foliage and habitats have really come bursting back to life. And so, southeastern Australia looks very green at the moment. So you have to hope some of that CO2 has been sucked back up again. But of course, these ecosystems, although they look as though they've recovered to some degree, they're not back to anything like they were before. And they're some of these ecosystems, you know, as we were saying, are perhaps forever changed.
We used to look forward to summer here on the West Coast. And now I kind of wonder, well, is this the year when our house burns down? And I've been on Bondi Beach in Sydney when summers were really carefree. It was fabulous. But in the recent Black Summer, Sydney was the hottest place on the planet for a day or so. Is it your sense disasters change people's feeling and belief about security in the future?
Oh, definitely. During Black Summer, there were fears for what summer would mean in Australia in the future. And, you know, there have been cases in Australia, in Australia and Adelaide in previous summers where the heat waves were so bad that the electricity grid was actually going down. So I think there are concerns whether everyone's going to be able to kind of adequately air condition and find safe spaces in heat waves in the future. And also during Black Summer, I mean, normally here in Sydney, we'd be spending a lot of our time on the beach or having barbecues and enjoying time outdoors. But during the Black Summer, particularly in December, the smoke was so thick that really we were just spending most of our time indoors. It was unpleasant being outside. It wasn't time to go to the beach. And even if you did make it down to the beach, there was certain ash and, you know, washing up in the surf as well. But it certainly made people think about what summer is going to be like and how inhabitable Australia is going to be in the future.
I feel I've met some new people almost in the creatures that you introduced so well in your new book. I wonder, will this concern and love for animals have to turn into more climate activism now that we see that is one of the biggest threats to animals as well as all the other things we do to them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the best thing that people can do is vote for politicians that support emissions mitigation strategies. Yeah, but I think in the wake of the fires here, there was some climate skepticism, but I think really a lot of that has evaporated. And even the Australian federal government, which really wasn't very interested in cutting carbon emissions and staying back on coal production prior to the fires, has sort of slowly, quietly began to be pressing for emissions mitigation strategies here. So I think in the wake of the fires, we are seeing some positive change here in Australia. And I think there's definitely a recognition that, you know, we run the risk of losing some of Australia's really stunning natural qualities and environments, places like the Great Barrier Reef. And I think that's coming home to people now, and they're realising that really we need to be looking to a sort of zero emission future here in Australia.
So we're getting towards the end of our time together, but what do you hope your new book, Flames of Extinction, will do? It's kind of a mixture of hope and horror for me.
Yeah, I mean, I really tried very hard with the book to find the more positive tales of people doing hopeful things to try and overcome the awfulness of Black Summer. And yeah, just I hope that people don't feel too much in despair after reading the book, and they're able to take some of these positive, more hopeful tales and realize that it means that there really is something we can do to prevent the sort of worst effects of climate change here in Australia, and realise that there are some positive things that people can go out there and do, and it's not too late to save Australia's wildlife and ecosystem.
From Australia, we've been speaking with expert science journalist John Pickerel. Look for his book, Flames of Extinction, and you can follow him on Twitter, John_Pickerel, and that's spelled P-I-C-K-R-E-L-L. And you can find more in my own weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. John, thank you for reporting on the other species that are experiencing climate change and the tales of Australia. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was great to speak to you.
I'm Alex Smith.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We just heard in a single fire season in Australia doubled that country's greenhouse gas emissions. Add in the great fires in California and throughout the West. Now toss in Siberian fires that don't even make the news. Are we experiencing a carbon burst from struggling forests giving up? New studies say the Amazon rainforest is now a carbon source instead of a sink. Certainly, carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere have never been higher in the time of humans. It surfaced above 420 parts per million in spring 2021, already halfway to doubling pre-industrial levels of carbon dioxide. As scientist David Brashears told us, nobody knows if greening further north or the carbon fertilization effect can balance out carbon loss to heat, drought, and fires. And that's not to mention rampant slashing and logging of rainforests from the Amazon to the Congo to Indonesia. We are going blindly into a game played by forces much larger than humanity. Changing the climate is a massive experiment with lives far beyond our own, billions of other types of living things. The longer we delay climate action, the deeper the suffering for all species. There will always be a pandemic, a war, some economic breakdown, another worthy priority, a social cause to explain why we can delay and let the greenhouse effect roar out of control. We already entered the hallway of extreme weather. We're in it now. There is no calm, peaceful time for year-long negotiations. There is no better time than now, during this time of crisis. We can still stop the worst. Thank you for listening and learning and caring about all the wondrous life on this small planet.